This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And still to come in the second half of today's show, we hear from Casey Bookman, who's running for a seat on the North Dakota Public Service Commission. But first, we're going to start with counseling during a pandemic. I'm joined now by Carol Kapan-Rachensky, a counselor and the founder of the Center for Compassion and Creativity. Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley, for having me.
I'll just start with, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Like everyone, this has been a time of uncertainty and change and adaptation. You know, I think we're all in that together. No one's life is unchanged.
Well, and some of those changes, I presume, like everyone else, is that a good part of our workload, as much as possible, has shifted to online. Are you doing exclusively online, or are you doing some online, some in-person counseling?
Yeah, you know, I'm doing mostly online. I have had a few exceptions to that. It's summer, so we can be outdoors. So I've had a little bit of walk and talk counseling, which is a totally new thing, but very safe in terms of COVID, to go for a walk with masks. And I also had a group that was ongoing when COVID hit, and we actually canceled it for a couple of months, and we picked it back up about a month ago, and we actually sat outside on lawn chairs in some green space around my office.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah, it was really nice. And it was really nice to have the group gather in person to have our conclusion. But largely, I have been working over Zoom. There's a few exceptions to that, people who would rather come in, or people, sometimes people don't have the privacy or the space to do a Zoom call at home or at work. So my office is pretty, we can easily do about a 7-foot distance between chairs, and we've picked up some good practices about cleaning and sanitizing. So, but it's mostly been over Zoom, which is a very different reality.
Yeah. Well, let's just start right there then. When it comes to counseling on Zoom, we'll start with the disadvantages, because, you know, maybe we can end on a high note here. you mentioned privacy already, and I'm thinking kids screaming at home, or someone who might have something that they just don't feel comfortable saying in front of a significant other. So what privacy concerns are you hearing?
Yeah, that's the main one. But people are so resourceful. I've seen so many people who actually have gone for a drive and parked in the park with their cell phone, and we've had a Zoom session, me from my home or my office, and them from their car. So, you know, I'd say for the most part, people have adapted really well and have been willing to learn some new technology to make that possible. But, you know, I think there are some downsides for sure. Sometimes the privacy issues, sometimes it's a little bit harder maybe to make that initial connection with people. Counselors really depend on body language and behavior, as well as verbal cues as to, you know, what's happening with this person who came to sit with me and, you know, do some counseling.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's a little bit tougher now. I don't find that with people that I've been working with for a long time. I know them really well. They know me really well. I can read facial expressions, and I've got a, you know, I've got a nice background of connection with them.
Well, let's talk about that body language issue.
Yeah.
What would be a couple of the top things that you as a trained counselor would be looking for if I say something, but perhaps my posture indicates something else?
Yeah, so I'm going to pay attention to things like, how steady is your eye contact? How consistent is it? You know, if you're holding your arms around yourself, that can, you know, be some lack of safety that we need to talk about. You know, honestly, sometimes it's just the very, like a knee that's shaking up and down, up and down, up and down, right? I can't see that on Zoom, but a lot of people's anxiety will manifest in just that kind of a signal that, if someone's in my office, I can very easily talk about that and notice that.
Sure. How do you make eye contact on Zoom? I feel like I'm only ever looking at myself.
Oh, well, I have myself in the very small, picture in the lower right and the full screen of my client, so that's helpful. And I know we're supposed to look at the camera, but I know
I
I find myself
know,
going back
but
and
you want
forth
to look at
between,
their eyes.
I want to look at their face. Exactly. So, there's that can be a little bit more difficult. As always, finding a counselor is part of the process. And, might be a little bit harder to get information about if, this is the person you want to see. It's always good to check, credentials and get meaningful referrals, either from their doctor or another health professional who knows you. Trusted family and friends are also good referrals.
We talked about privacy in the sense of, okay, I've got a screaming toddler at home and I just can't, you just can't talk over that. But also there is a sense of when you're walking into somebody else's space that it becomes a healing space in a way that I'm sitting in my bedroom, and maybe even if I've had a relationship with a counselor or therapist for some years, I'm looking, oh, I really need to paint this, or oh, I forgot to dust, or you're thinking about house projects.
Yeah, exactly. And counselors pay a lot of attention to space. I'm very mindful of the sounds in my space and the lighting and the feel of it, the sense of coming into a waiting room and moving into a back office that's really private. So yeah, I don't have those tools to work with, which does make a difference. And I agree. I have met more of my clients' children than I have ever in my 28 years of doing this work because, like you said, many children like to pop in and who's that and what's happening and So yeah, there's some issues of that certainly that are distracting, certainly more for my clients than for me. I can, absorb that pretty easily. Of course, there's also tech issues, right? I
Well,
mean, we all
that's a
know
thing.
Zoom is imperfect. It's so that's been a problem sometimes in terms of people's location. Maybe they don't have great reception, so we have to stumble over some of those things that certainly aren't part of face-to-face work.
Well, meeting those kids, has there been an instance since early March where maybe you were able to pick up on something just because you see it in the interaction parent-child that you maybe wouldn't even have had a clue about?
Yeah, I think that has happened where I have you had a chance to witness, maybe an interaction with their child or even an interaction with an elderly parent that they happen to be staying with or caring for. It can bring new topics into the room, certainly. Yeah, not only relational, but even space things, if people are, some people have been zooming from their closet or from their garage. Well, it's a good topic to talk about. How is there no space for you to find, a corner in your house?
How about some tips for setting up that space? If it is a garage, can we, bring in some soft lighting and some candles? Or, like you said, counselors spend a lot of time paying attention to how a person moves through a room. It smells good at a counselor's office,
Yeah, I mean, I ask people to find a place that they're comfortable, to find a chair that's really supportive for them. I ask them to ask people to give them an hour, that it will just be an hour. And if they're able to do that, that's really helpful. But of course, with kids, that's not always possible.
They're on their own clocks.
Exactly. And an hour is forever, when you're four. An hour is a very long time.
What about Zoom when it comes to client counselor confidentiality? I know there are different levels of privacy and security. What do you have to do as a counselor to make sure that your clients are protected in this online environment? Because we know Zoom can be hacked.
Right, it can be hacked. And my I'm a licensed professional counselor, and our professional organization, the American Counseling Association, has they pretty early came out and said that Zoom will be the preferred platform and how to, you know, secure a room that requires a password and use a waiting room. So you have to let people in the waiting room. Nobody can come in without your permission as the host. And I'm always the host. Mm-hmm. So there's been some real helpful guidance about that.
Well, that's good.
And then for me, I just am sure that I'm, you know, either alone at home or alone in my office and have the same protocols I would with a face-to-face session.
Sure, I didn't even think about that.
All the confidentiality remains in place.
Yeah. Have you seen a change in the kinds of issues that people are coming to you with? Like, we're in a time of increased social isolation.
You know, I think just coping with the isolation and the lockdown and the lack of access to ways that we normally move around our community, whether that's, you know, we go to a faith service or we go to a book club or we go to the library board that we sit on, you know, all of that has changed and people have really gotten, I think, in touch with how much we rely on those kinds of things to fill our social needs and our human family needs. So I think a lot of my conversation has been just about, you know, how are you doing? How are you doing with the global pandemic and whatever that's bringing to you? And then how are you doing even with what else is going on in the world with the social justice work that's going on? So it may be a little bit more immediate right now in terms of content than it usually is, where counseling tends to look at our history and look at our present and make connections and seek patterns and that kind of thing. Where with COVID-19, I've done a lot of just how are you going to do this? How can you best do this? How can you do this with compassion for yourself? And, you know, I noticed at the beginning, I would say from March to, let's say, May, I was saying these three things to people. I was saying, go outside and walk around. You're not on house arrest, because people were just, you know, really just staying in their house.
Yeah.
And I was really concerned about that. So I was suggesting anyone who could go outside, even if it's just a walk around the block. And then I was asking people to do some projects, even just one a day that has a beginning, a middle, and end. That's so satisfying when we're in a situation that's difficult, number one, and number two, we don't have a timeline. So I said, you know, just set, whether you make a pan of brownies or you clean out that junk drawer or but do something that has a beginning, middle, and end, that's an activity. So you get that sense of completion.
Yeah, that closure.
Right, right. And then I also said, learn something new. So learn a new language, learn to, you know, cook Thai food, learn to play the ukulele. Oh my goodness, we're in such a rich resource time in terms of learning things, whether it's YouTube or other platforms that people can pick up new skills.
Yeah.
So I was saying that during those months, right? Just go outside, do some projects that have a beginning, middle, and end, and learn something new. Mm-hmm. And that seemed, you know, like that was helpful during those early months. Those are still good things, but now I find myself saying, every day do something that you can't do in the winter. Because winter's coming, and that might be just eating outside on your own patio or on a patio of a local establishment, or just walking barefoot in your grass. But let's just really honor that we have really had some ease come to us during the pandemic, during the softer, warmer weather.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, I'm one of those people who kind of picked up on that simple sourdough thread out there for learning something new. But then I also, like, there's a danger there, almost in the same way that we compare ourselves to other people in general, but especially on social media, where there was this enormous pressure to spend this time learning something new. And you can almost create anxiety that you didn't, I don't know, learn Korean or something, when all of a sudden you also had, you know, three kids at home and had to teach them and you know, had to learn how to work from home. So there is a balancing act there.
It is a balancing act for sure. And it's very different for different people. I've heard that saying, I'm sure everyone has by now, which is that we're all in the same storm, but we're in very different boats.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, some people's boats, you know, are little rowboats, and they're being tossed around. They're losing loved ones and jobs and income and health and opportunities and also social contacts in their normal routines. And some people, like you said, have, you know, their losses are more the routine and the social connection and the support that, of course, our educational system provides for our kids. They're very different. There are losses and they all involve some grief. But they're very different. And I have a lot of nurses in my family, so I've been able to stay pretty clear that, you know, this, not everyone was staying home making sourdough, right?
Right, yeah.
They were working, you know, round the clock practically, mm-hmm. especially the ones in long-term care.
Absolutely.
Had their, you know, world completely turned upside down. So I think when I say compassion for ourselves, but also compassion for each other, that we're all in a time we've never lived through before, we've never coped with before. And for some of us, our boat's pretty darn sturdy. We haven't lost income. Maybe we haven't lost loved ones either. Maybe we haven't lost, you know, opportunities even in our profession. Maybe our profession is asking more of us than ever. That's another kind of stress.
Yeah.
But yeah, my hope is that we can come through this knowing that however we come through it, we will have all come through it, and we will probably all have lost people. Some people won't come through it. But we need to have compassion for people whose experience was different than ours mm-hmm. and still difficult.
We're visiting with licensed professional counselor and founder of the Center for Compassion and Creativity, Carol Kapan-Rachensky. And early in that last answer, Carol, you said grief, but not in the context of losing a human, which I think is the most common mm-hmm. sense of grief, if
right.
we've lost a human or a beloved pet in our lives, but mm-hmm. a job loss or just someone we used to, our favorite person at our favorite deli or,
right.
or what have
right.
you. What does mm-hmm. that kind of grief look like? Does it manifest in the body or in our minds any differently?
No, I think it actually manifests very similar. That loss is really loss. It's the same minor note on our emotional scale. And so whether we lose our own health or we lose our own sense of competence or we lose our own ability to see the people we care about the most, or we do lose our income or our job or a loved one, or just lose our simple routines that really anchor us in the world, like you said, the coffee shop you go to, the deli you stop by, the you know, the librarian who always knows just what you ought to read next.
Those
are all losses that provide us with meaning and you know, and really with love in mm-hmm. the in the world. So if we think of those stages of grief that, yes, of course, mostly people bring to mind around a death of a loved one, you can see them in any of these other losses. When we lose something we don't want to lose, we lose mm-hmm. something that we wish we didn't, we can get angry. We can mm-hmm. deny that it's happening even. It's not that important. You know, we can bargain like, well, how about maybe if we all do this, this won't be so hard. Or maybe I bet if I go to church online, it'll be just like it is in person. And then it's not. And that's a sad thing to accept. And there's a depression in the series of grief feelings for sure. Just plain sadness. And I think with a pandemic particularly, we're really dealing with a lot of powerlessness, that we can do our little part to keep us and our loved ones safe. But I'm not going to discover the vaccine. I don't think you are either, Ashley.
No, not unless it's at the bottom of an ice cream tub.
Well, there you go. And, you know, that can unite us, but it can also be isolating. Because I think a lot of us are feeling a lot of powerlessness and we want to be able to come together in that and see our shared humanity in that mm-hmm. instead of just feel the difficulty of not being able to do something to fix all this. Then the last stage is acceptance, which is, this is really hard. This really hurts. May I be kind to myself in this moment? This is part of being human, and lots of other people feel this too. And I'm just going to try and be kind to myself as we go through this and as we come through this.
How about let's talk about some of the advantages that can come from moving to primarily an online space.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing, and I don't know this, but you maybe had clients in the past who couldn't see you anymore because they moved. Have you seen a return of clients?
I have, which has been really rewarding because, yes, I'm seeing people who are on a different continent who I used to see when they were here, and they've gotten in touch with me and said, I see on your website, you're Zooming, I can see you again. So that's been great. Wow. And I have to say, online therapy is here to stay.
Yeah.
There's no question about that for several reasons. One is the research that's happening is saying clients are equally satisfied. The outcomes are equally good. So it's really wonderful, but it's also really reassuring that we are going to come out of this having gained another way to work and a whole nother tool. Prior to this, online counseling was mostly happening in rural areas where there weren't a lot of mental health services. Which meant that insurance companies and even employee assistance programs, for instance, in Fargo, weren't covering online work because people could come see a counselor in person. That was the tradition. That's how you did your billing. But now that's changed. And because of COVID-19, those third-party payment people have had to cover online work. And like I said, the outcomes are looking so strong that that's going to continue for sure. The other thing is that, it's more time effective. My office is pretty far south in Fargo. And for someone to, let's say, who works at, NDSU to come see me, it's 2 hours out of their day, even in Fargo, right?
Right.
Where our traffic is not that much of a problem. But when they can close their office door, it's much easier. It's much more convenient and takes an hour. Instead of 2 hours to run across town, run back across town.
Sure.
So that's definitely a plus.
I feel like I would bring my cat.
You'd bring your cat. Well, yeah. I have to tell you, many people have brought, not only do I meet children, I also meet pets. So yes, absolutely.
Well, they're very calming too. I mean, there's a reason they say therapy dogs and therapy pets.
Absolutely. And there's no question that COVID has increased the demand for mental health services, especially for people who do have some depression that they manage and probably manage, pretty competently without a big negative event going on that they have no power to control. And the other reason I would say that it's going to stick around is people like it. People are saying to me all the time, can we keep doing it like this? And I would never have guessed that. I would never have guessed that would happen, but people really like it. Now, for me as a counselor, there's this other gift to it, which is, about a month ago, I suppose, I went up and stayed at my brother's cabin on Leech Lake, Minnesota, and I kept working. But in the evening, I went for a pontoon ride, and I went out for dinner with my brother and his family.
Yeah.
So, there's a gift of freedom in it. That's available to both chairs. Not only to my clients is there some freedom in it, but for me, there's definitely some freedom in it too.
Carol Kapan-Rachensky is a licensed professional counselor and the founder of the Center for Compassion and Creativity. Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. It was fun to talk to you.
Still to come on Main Street, one of the candidates for the North Dakota Public Service Commission. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated a problem North Dakota schools have been facing for a while, hiring substitute teachers. Nick Archuleta is the president of North Dakota United, an organization that represents teachers.
Oftentimes, the substitute teachers are retired teachers who like to keep involved in education, make a couple of bucks, and are reinvigorated by hanging around young people. But since so many of them over the age of 60, they're very concerned about substitute teaching and possibly being infected with the coronavirus.
North Dakota Council of Educational Leaders Executive Director Amy Kopas says even before the pandemic, her organization has been asking the Department of Public Instruction for some temporary relief on the rules governing substitute teachers.
currently, the substitute guidelines require a high school diploma plus additional hours of collegiate credit, equivalent about to an associate's degree, to be a substitute teacher. And we're seeking some relief on whether or not we could lighten a few of those additional requirements. And of course, still maintaining all of the pieces with background checks and things like that. But perhaps as we struggle with what was already a shortage, and again, it's compounded greatly.
COPA says there are wonderful people in the educational community, some who serve as paraprofessionals, who don't meet the requirements for substitute teachers. North Dakota's COVID-19 death toll is now 148, with three more individuals passing away with the disease. The patients were a woman in her 90s from Williams County, a man in his 70s from Morton County, and a woman in her 80s from Burleigh County. They each had underlying health conditions. Additionally, 265 new individuals from 30 counties have tested positive for COVID-19, bringing the new statewide positive total to 12,267. These results are from a pool of 5,786 tests for a daily positive rate of 4.58%. And Moorhead Mayor Jonathan Judd joined Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and others at Blue Stem Amphitheater to show his support for legislation to help the entertainment industry survive the pandemic. Judd says Blue Stem, which has been empty this spring and summer, is an important part of the Fargo-Moorhead economy.
Over 34,000 folks here, again, coming from 43 states, six Canadian provinces. That's going to have an economic impact on your city and this region. We're talking about people who stay in hotels, frequent our restaurants, and it's also a residual effect of people just using their money to purchase goods and items here.
Also on hand was concert promoter Jade Nielsen of Jade Presents, who has been forced to cancel numerous shows and events. The bill, co-sponsored by Klobuchar, would provide $10 billion to the industry. The Saving Our Stages Act would provide small business grants to independent organizations who own or promote concerts and other events around the country. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Although Theodore Roosevelt was one of the strongest and most charismatic of American presidents, he could not have accomplished all that he did without his circle of friends and advisors. Explore TR's Inner Circle during the 15th Annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium, September 17th through the 19th. This virtual event features three keynote speakers and a tour of the rugged Badlands. This event is sponsored by Dickinson State University and Prairie Public. Register online at dickinsonstate.edu/TR.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Casey Bookman, who is running for commissioner to be on the Public Service Commission. Casey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, yeah, it's great that I can be on your show, and it's a pleasure. And it's sad that we have to do this online, I mean, by a phone and stuff. But, you know, with the way things are, this is quite all right.
It does make a difference to have the right technology in place. This pandemic would certainly be something else without a lot of the tech infrastructure that we have.
Yes.
Why Public Service Commission?
Well, when I ran in 2018, I didn't think, my wife looked at me and she said, you're not done yet. Mm. And I said, no, not really. I'm not done yet. But I still think that there's a lot left to do in the Public Service Commission. And that's why I run. I think that we still need a working man in our state government, a true working one man, one who is actually has the scars to show it instead of just paper cuts.
And a working man, you're an iron worker.
Yeah, I'm a union iron worker, been in it over 30 years. Actually, November 2nd is my birthday, and that's the day I'll retire from my union. And it has done really good. And hopefully, come November 3rd, I'll have a really good birthday present.
How do you think that being an iron worker, if elected, could inform your role as a public service commissioner?
My trade has prepared me for anything that the Public Service Commission has to handle. I've had over 300 people of all different trades work under me, and I've done various, you know, big projects around the state. You know, one of the most notable on the new Sanford Hospital, I was in charge of the east wing up there, And, you know, if that's for any instance, if people have any doubt, if I'm prepared to run to hold that office. And also, in many many instances, the areas that I've worked in, I've actually worked in 7 of the 11 areas or used them for my job or in related to in my job as a union iron worker. So my job as a union iron worker has not only prepared me for the Public Service Commission, but it also has prepared me to deal with outside entities and with them.
So coming at this from the perspective of having worked under the regulations that are set by the Public Service Commission, what would you change if elected?
Well, one of the things that the PSC does a lot, and I've heard them say it, that they only regulate, they don't legislate, and they leave that up to the legislative branch of the government. Well, for me, that just tells me they're kind of lazy. Because if you see something wrong in an area that you're regulating, then you should be able to go in and talk to your legislator or write it up yourself. Any citizen or anybody can make up a law for Century Code, and you just present it to the legislature. So, you know, when we look at that, that's one thing I will change. I would make sure that the things that I see that are wrong, that we can hopefully get them changed by legislative action if they're that severe. So I would definitely talk to the other sides of the government.
So what are Casey Bookman's top priorities?
The top priorities, I truly believe, are the infrastructure of our natural gas pipelines and oil pipelines. I would work, even though we regulate it and stuff, I truly believe we need to talk to people and have a discussion with our legislature on getting either a study on how much it would cost to make sure that we could expand our infrastructure to the pipeline infrastructure for natural gas to all the citizens of North Dakota, since we have abundance and it would reduce flaring. Another area is broadband, making sure that fast, affordable broadband is equal to all people. You know, the more money you got, it seems like the faster your broadband can be. And also on that, I'm really into net metering, and not too many people know about it in North Dakota. Net metering is, you know, you produce your own, basically in a nutshell, you produce your own electricity for your place or residence, and you sell it back to the grid. And with renewables and everything coming deeper and faster, I think we need to look at that and give people an area where they can be have zero costs and electrical costs to them for their houses. Even communities can look at that. Even co-ops can look at that. There's just different ways, because the way that our energy and power grid is changing, and it's going to change fast. And we need to have people in the Public Service Commission who will adapt to that change. And I don't think that my opponent and his party, period, really adapt to anything.
We do already have the ability to sell power back to the grid. What would be the difference with net metering?
Well, it's basically the same thing, but no people. Net metering is individuals. You know, and that's the same thing what we're talking about, but it's not really talked about. You know, we have a lot of sun in North Dakota, believe it or not, and they have come so far with solar technology. You know, that it's unbelievable. You know, I believe in all of the above energy process, you know, along with wind and solar, geothermal, and everything like that. People have been sold a bill of goods about coal. I'm going to tell you what, I've worked in the coal industry for most of my life in some way or another, and it is on a downhill slide. When people think about the steel industry or the car industry, those people who worked in those industries did not think their jobs would go away. But every industry or manufacturing has a shelf life, and as with the car and steel manufacturing and that industry, coal industry does have a shelf life. Will we entirely get rid of it? I truly do not believe. I don't think we'll get rid of all of the fossil fuel imprint in our society, but we will. But we can do it as the technology increases and advances. We need to embrace it and expand on that to make sure that each individual town community has access to affordable, cheaper energy for them.
We're visiting with Casey Bookman. This is part of our Meet the Candidates series for anyone running for statewide office. You can read more about his platform at caseybookman.com, and that's CaseyBuchmann.com. And he is challenging Commissioner Brian Crotius to sit on the North Dakota Public Service Commission. And Casey, you also mentioned that among your top concerns, broadband internet, and I'm thinking specifically during a pandemic, has really highlighted the need for this across the state as more and more people are using it to either work from home or attend school. What have you noticed specific to the pandemic that has maybe changed how you think about broadband internet access?
Well, the pandemic has really exposed, it's twofold. It exposed where our state government is lacking, and that's one bad thing. And the good thing, it says that people can, with the society and the internet today, we can work from home. So, you know, and it expands a company's way to hire instead of having to have them come to a big city. They can hire, like in Minneapolis, out in, let's say, in Solon, North Dakota, which is really rural. And the coverage or anything broadband down there or fiber optics is really not the best. So if we want to really make this a world economy, which is gradually trending to, and people don't want to admit it, but it's gradually trending to, with the internet and everything like that, we need to make sure that everybody has access to the same speed of internet so that no one is left behind. You know, when we talk about with the pandemic, you know, parents may want to teach their kids at home now. We want to make sure everything in the rural areas has just as much access to the internet and broadband as in the urban areas.
What would need to be done in order for that to happen?
We need to be able to put in more stuff, more fiber optics, and more just to expand it. We need to have a dialogue. We need to go back to, which I believe, to our nonpartisan league roots as a state. We need to take the problem that we see it as a state, and we need to solve it like the nonpartisan league did when they first come up. And we need to use our legacy funds to do that. We could use the interest off it, off the legacy fund, to help areas across the state. But we need to start now, not in 10 years, not in 20 years. We need to start now in many of the areas I'm talking about that are on my platform to expand on it.
As you said yourself, the PSC is a regulatory body, not a legislative body. They're not able to make laws or secure funding. What difference does it make where the funding would come from for this? Could you even impact that on the commission?
Well, you know, I'm a nonpartisan leaguer, and my grandpa was a nonpartisan leaguer, dues-paying nonpartisan leaguer, and I am also a dues-paying nonpartisan leaguer. You know, I believe that here in North Dakota, with our uniqueness, we're commodity based, we have our legacy fund, we have the opportunity to expand each individual with our one-time harvest. Instead of most of that money going down to Texas and Louisiana, you know, we can keep that money here. And as a public service commission, you know, yeah, I only regulate, but what is not as a citizen? And that also as a public service commission, if I see something wrong, you know, and if I'm in an area where I'm an elected official, that brings more clout in my mind, my opinion, to what they're talking about. I think that our elected leaders get hung up in so much of what they're only doing or trying to lack up doing this thing that they forget about the people.
You've called yourself a nonpartisan leaguer a couple of times. Of course, you're running on the ticket of the Democratic NPL party, and it has been since Bruce Hagan, who served starting back in 1961, he has been the only non-Republican in the multi-decade history of the North Dakota PSC to serve. What do you think your chances are?
My chances are good. I'm not going to, you know, I really believe they're good. You know, for me, I know that the nonpartisan league resonates out in the rural North Dakota, and it resonates in the urban areas too. And we need to get back to, you know, people will say we just go back to the old days. Well, let's not, you know, reinvent the wheel, but let's take how we got here and use parts and how to do that. And the nonpartisan league was very instrumental in making North Dakota what it is today. If we have more leaders who follow that principles, and I'm, you know, running for PSC, and I follow the nonpartisan league principles of where the land and the people come first inside North Dakota instead of out-of-state interests, and keep the money inside and working for North Dakota, that therein lies the difference between me and my opponent and the GOP.
You ran for this office in 2018. What's different about your campaign now, if anything?
The biggest difference, I think, would be name recognition, to be honest with you. You know, I have from 2018, if you get a basic a diagram of where you need to make up votes. You can just go online to the Secretary of State's office and see where everybody voted it, and you don't know where to concentrate to try and meet people and sway them to vote for you. So in 2018, I really didn't have that. This time I've had that. I've been using it. I spent a lot of time out here in the eastern part of the state. Actually, I'm calling from Grand Forks right now. And so I've spent a lot of time out in the Red River Valley talking to them, you know, up in Devil's Lake and everything where the populace is. But also I spent the same amount of time out in rural North Dakota making sure that they hear that they know that there's a person who has nonpartisan league values that believes that the land and people can work together for the betterment of all.
How has it been campaigning in a pandemic year? I don't know that I would be wanting to open my door up to just anyone knocking on it.
Well, I totally understand that, you know, and, you know, even, that's even fundraising and everything else. Everything's different, and, you know, and you just got to smile and go on and persevere. You know, unlike our opponents who have way more major out-of-state donors than I do and stuff like that, we have to work. We have to constantly work, and we have to figure out ways, ingenious ways to go out and meet people. I've had meet and greets, been to several meet and greets where, you know, you are masked up and you do your social distancing, but yet you're still trying to make the impression. People know, and I know that for a fact, they're still longing for communication now, and it's getting more and more and more. You know, as things get worse in our state, as in cases and everything, you know, who knows how long this will go. And we just need leaders all across the board, up and down in our state, who realize that, who are not afraid to talk to our governor and say, hey, just because you got the big bucks doesn't mean I'm not scared of telling you this is the way to do it. Because I think people are scared of our governor because they're going to put money against them in their campaign. That is so wrong. You know, that's not the nonpartisan league way. That is very wrong. Money should not run a state. It should not run the state like a business. And like a business, as our state and our country is both going downhill.
What's it cost to run for PSC?
I don't. You know, with donations this year, I couldn't even tell you how much I got. It might be the same as last year, I mean, 2018. You know, if you really want to run a competitive race, it's like you've got to run, you know, between $50,000 to $100,000. And again, in 2018, I did not even raise, I don't know, we'll say $25,000. I still finished, in percentage-wise in votes, third on a statewide ticket for not being a well-known name. And I thought that was really encouraging. And this year with the known, I know my name is known. I know people recognize me, and I truly believe they resonate with the nonpartisan league values that I bring.
You know, we've talked about it being a strange year for campaigning. It's also going to be a strange year for voting, with some people likely choosing to do mail-in voting. What are your recommendations for all voters, even those who wouldn't be voting for you?
Well, I mean, vote. You know, whether you vote or not, exercise your right as a citizen of North Dakota and our state to do your duty. Their due diligence duty to vote, you know, whether for whoever of your choice. In North Dakota, we have absentee voting. If you're unsecure with that, about voting in person, make sure you can get on the Secretary of State's website or go to my website, www.caseybookman.com, and I have a links and drop downs that will send you to the Secretary of State's office and file for a absentee ballot. You know, our family does it. I've been doing it all the time my whole life. And there's times that I don't send it in and I go vote in person. But, you know, we still in North Dakota, we have that option. And that is so great.
You said in a previous interview that former Governor Art Link is your hero. Why?
I'll tell you the story when I first met him in 1972. He was running for governor. They just downgraded from, we used to have two legislatures in Congress, and he was a Western congressional delegate, and he was running for governor in 1972, and he came to my hometown in Stanton, North Dakota, where I grew up at, and I was with my grandpa. My grandpa was a state government hunter. Governor Link and my grandpa were about the same length. And my grandpa took me in his hand. We were hand-to-hand when we walked up to Governor Link, and he introduced me to then-candidate Governor Link. This is the first time in my whole life I remember a grown adult getting down on one knee and looking me eye to eye, and we had a discussion. I couldn't tell you what we talked about, what went on, but the impression in his voice had made so much to me, and as a person, as he's seen what, because I grew up in coal country, what has happened and how he handled the coal boom when it first come on and everything, and how he did that, how the Land Reclamations Act came about through him and many other people to help get it passed in the federal government. That's true leadership. That's true nonpartisan leadership. And then when I went to go see him, lying in wait when he passed away and everything, you know, I mean, it was like, for me, it was like losing, I hadn't seen him in years. For me, it was like losing a family member. And, you know, and that was it. His impression that he left, his legacy in North Dakota from my first meeting him in 1972 when I was 9 years old until he passed away. And to this day, I get choked up by it because that's how much it means to me.
Casey Bookman is running for a seat on North Dakota's Public Service Commission. You can find out more at caseybookman.com. Casey, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you for having me, and I really do appreciate it. And just remember, everybody, go vote. You know, do our duty as citizens of the state and country to go vote. No matter who you vote for, vote.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 2nd. On this date in 1899, the telephone installed at the Chicago and Northwestern Railway Depot in Oaks, North Dakota, was up and working. According to the Oaks Republican, the depot was now in close touch with the rest of the world. 1899 might seem early for telephone service, but the Northwestern Depot did not have the state's first telephone. That honor belonged to Oliver Dalrymple's Bonanza Farm. Dalrymple purchased his telephone from Philadelphia in 1876.
Alexander Graham Bell had patented his telephone earlier that year. Dalrymple had the battery-powered device installed at the headquarters farm. The first North Dakota use of the new-fangled machines allowed for fast communications between the main farm and the divisional farms. A few years later, in 1881, the Fargo-Moorhead Telephone Exchange opened for business. By June of that year, there were 10 miles of phone lines in Fargo. Local businessmen funded the venture with $5,000. The exchange was in the attic of the headquarters hotel. The switchboard had 25 connections. James Hull Sr. installed the first telephone in the city at his farm, located at what is now 1233 Broadway. The headquarters hotel, the Republican Party office, and the Daily Argus were among the first subscribers. The exchange charged $4.98 per month for a private line. A two-party line was $4.10, and a four-party line was $3.51. The first long-distance telephone call in North Dakota was between Fargo and St. Cloud in 1887. The telephone exchange moved several times, locating for a time where City Hall would later be built, then to a three-story brick building on the corner of Roberts Street and 2nd Avenue North. In 1902, it moved to 504 1st Avenue North, a new building constructed with the exchange in mind. The first telephone operator was 15-year-old Bella Thompson. Mrs. C.E. Webster became the second operator. They were paid $25 a month. The director of the exchange said he hired women because boys were too likely to engage in pranks and talk back to customers. Operators handled all calls until 1939. In that year, the exchange established automatic dialing service. In 2002, a Fargo resident finally turned her old dial phone in for a push-button model. She also had the last party line in the city. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Racial division is not confined to big cities. We visit a small town in Oregon where Black Lives Matter activists...
I've had so many people say we didn't have racism here until I started the protest.
...have clashed with neighbors and counter-protesters.
It's 2020. Nobody cares about the color of your skin anymore. We really don't.
Protests in Prineville on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we hear from musician Tom Brissot, host of the show The Great American Folk Show. It's airing this weekend on Prairie Public, and he joins us to preview his guests for this episode. Also, we'll hear from Sue Balcom. It's time for another Main Street Eats. I'm already hungry. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.